Welcome, everybody, to an episode of... Damn it!
Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of Fangs and Fonts. I'm your host, Yanara.
I'm Roland.
I'm another host, Ocean.
I'm the last in this roll call, Voice.
I was going to say, don't forget your name this time.
Yeah, well, I have so many of them.
Well, that's because you're good at world building.
Ooh.
Oh.
I like this.
Good. I like it when we jump straight to the topic at
hand. One for each world.
One for each multiple personality.
What things about world building will we be talking about today?
Multiple personalities and how they help.
Infinite Earths.
Infinite Earths. It's actually kind of funny because we were just watching the Justice League with the multiple Earths. Yeah.
On the
which is how many of them actually, when you actually watch the, never mind.
But it was Crisis of Two Earths. It wasn't Crisis of Infinite Earths.
No, but they've...
Hinted.
I'll talk to you about comics after the show.
I'm Alternate World Voice.
I am C.
C?
Yes.
Oh.
Okay.
What'd you say? Your talk?
I would be touch.
Oh, I would call him talk.
I'd call you talk.
Damn it.
Your talk.
You'd be talk.
I'd
talk.
Be talk.
Talk and voice.
That's still, well, I guess, yeah.
What would he be?
Hold on.
Boring.
No. No, I'm sorry. That's,
what?
No, that was a bad.
No.
Bad, no, I apologize. I said boring.
In an alternate universe.
To be fair, though, that means that you're interesting in this universe.
Yes.
I'm still not completely convinced that's what you meant.
I don't know what I meant. It was the first thing that came to my
Wouldn't
mind.
Wouldn't you be Samsung?
What's the opposite of Roland?
He's named after a keyboard, so it would be another.
He's not. It just happens to.
Samsung is not a keyboard, but that's actually exactly what I was looking up. I can't fucking remember any of them.
Yamaha.
Yeah.
Moving on.
Yeah, Yamaha.
I'd probably be a Jaguar, because nobody knows what the hell the difference between a Jaguar and a cheetah is. So.
You'd be Stripes.
Maybe. I'd be the local Tiger Ops. You'd be the goddamn cheetah.
That's fine.
Oh, yeah.
We're off
to
a good start.
So, world building. What are we going to talk about in world building?
Well, how to handle world building. How much is too much? How much is just the sweet spot? Or as I like to call it, the Goldilocks zone.
Oh, God. Yeah, I do like that you should probably touch on, you know, how much is too much. We did touch on that on one of our panels at RF.
And then there's, of course, how to handle it in an anthropomorphic piece of fiction. How would you world build?
Mm-hmm.
It's as important, if not almost more important, than basically making your character furry and going with your furry traits.
So let me start off with asking, do you feel you have to put more world building into a world like a fantasy or a sci-fi environment versus something like a modern day slice of life?
You would have to.
Yeah, I think you would, just because with a modern day slice of life, everybody kind of already assumes that you're writing the here and the now and that they should be able to relate to what's happening in the book just because that's what they immediately assume would be going on.
Probably why writing those kinds of time frames are so popular. People don't have to put a lot of thought into world building.
Or it's just easier because that way they don't lose their word count to world building and then they can actually focus on their character development. Because I know one of the stories I tried to write one time, the world building ate up all my word count, and instead of deleting it or putting it aside, I just kind of went, you know what, I'm going to put this as a side project and do something else.
Does that also include historical fiction?
But historical fiction, you have to put world building into it because someone may pick up the book that doesn't understand the historical
aspects
of it. So you have to kind of explain what's going on, which is why generally with historical fiction, a lot of the books on how to write it sit there and say you have to do your research. Because you have to present a believable world to not only the people who are picking this up for the first time, but you have to be correct enough for the people who actually understand what that time period and are going, so they don't sit there and pick holes through your plot.
When you're writing the here and now, it's very easy to refer, you know, to default back to the 11 Secret Herbs and Spices But whenever I've written back, like, say, I wrote, I believe it was early, like, 18th century, and that required so much research. And, like,
your Trick or Treat 2 story?
Yeah, my Trick or Treat 2 story. And I wanted to fudge some of the details because I'm like, fuck, this is hard. Nope.
Because people pick that out from all your beta reads.
Yeah, and you think people won't notice, but they do. And they're like, they read it, and then something just seems off, and they're like, no.
And then they call you on it.
Yeah, they'll call you on it. And so when you're doing something like historical fiction, you can't fudge it. You
got to work.
Yeah.
Kind of a tangent question from that. It does relate to the same thing. Because whether you're writing any sort of story, there's always going to be that one person that pokes it like, no, it doesn't work this way. How far should you go to appease those people?
I would argue how close is your story to, like, real life history.
How fiction is your historical?
Like, well, when, not even fiction, but, like, in a hard sci-fi where people are going to start picking apart the science.
But see, hard sci-fi, you have to, because the very nature of hard sci-fi, you have to have that level of science. Otherwise, you're just doing, if you do normal sci-fi, I would say it's less important than if you're, say, doing hard sci-fi or even historical fiction. Because,
but how hard do you have to go into the sci-fi, kind of is what I mean. In the same sense of the historical fiction, like, how far do you need to make sure that every single detail is right?
In the context of what I was writing for Trick or Treat, is that what I was trying to do was emulate a very similar scenario to, like, 1800s Ireland. So the details in that are a lot more important than, say, if you're doing something that's only moderately based on medieval fiction, say, you know, I'll use Vol, for example. Very medieval, you know, historical fiction, but doesn't need to worry about keeping accurate detail so much because it's further removed from reality.
Well, another thing you have to keep in mind when you're trying to do, like, with the whole how accurate do you want your historical fiction to be? You have to think about what kind of balance do you want for how much fiction are you throwing in your historical notes there. And I think a real big problem with trying to do too big of a world building is your word count really limits a lot of what you can do. Because then you end up with these giant novellas like Jane M. Auld's, and she's got phenomenal world building, but each book is 2 inches thick because she's focused so much on world building, and a lot of people find it to be incredibly dry to read.
R. R. Martin, because
they spend so much time detailing everything, talking about the landscape, talking about.
I specifically hear about
everything.
Like the amount of food
Tolkien,
that is described.
Yeah.
Tolkien
did this.
Tolkien
yeah.
does it too, and it's
but everyone loves
it's
Tolkien.
A dry read, and you really have to kind of decide what kind of author do you want to be. Do you want to have your dialogue, and do you want to have
that's an important point: is what part do you want to be?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, what. I'm currently reading Ready Player One, which is a cyberpunk of a different flavor. You should. It's a good book. But the thing that's interesting in it is he's the creator of this giant MMO that is virtual reality based, was a fan of the 80s. So anyone who grew up in the 80s is going to pick this book up and know most of the references they're talking about. But And it's just the side mentions. You're like, oh, that's, I know that, I know that, I know that, I know that. But anything integral to the actual plot itself, he still details. And mostly because, you know, once the generation moves away from all the people who grew up in the 80s, people who pick this book up are going to have no bloody clue as to what he's talking about. So if it's integral to the plot, he has to still explain it. Like, there's a Dungeons & Dragons module where it's before my time, but he had to sit there and explain what was in it, and because it was integral to the plot.
Isn't it similar in Shakespeare today how, you know, a lot of the kids get the book that says the words, and then on the other side going, you wouldn't get this, but what he's referring to is this in this word.
Well, it's like, I bite my thumb at thee, you know, yeah, I bite my thumb at thee, and it's like, so? It's like, that's actually a huge insult.
Yeah.
Well, and that's kind of the thing about writing historical fiction. Like, at what point is it, quote-unquote, historical enough that you kind of stop explaining things? Because if you write something far enough away, nothing's going to be relevant anymore.
Take my Trick or Treat 2 story, which takes place in prehistory.
Funny that we're using the example from the anthology that is specifically about olden times.
Well,
the
historical Trick or Treat.
But the thing is the reason, one of the reasons I did that, and the same thing for my Pred Prey story where it was ancient Aztec, is because there is so little known, is that you can look up what little we know, and then you've got a lot more freedom to it. As soon as you go into recorded history, then you've got a little less and less to play with until you're up to modern times, and then it's just like, well, I know everything that's going on now. And you can write to your heart's content. However, if your book survives the next 20 years, people might pick it up and have no clue what you're talking about.
So let's talk a little bit about what world building involves. And let's use an example that we're all familiar with, which we all agreed had really good world building, Summerhill.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So what? Because we all had stated in our review that Kevin Frayn did a great job of building these different worlds. What about it exactly made us say that?
Well, let's take the cruise ship for example. How much of the cruise ship do we actually hear a description about?
Like one chapter.
But the actual description.
It's most of it's you in know the it's a cruise ship. Summerhill interacting with the crew.
Yeah, it's his interactions. It's all in the ballroom, and
like
the one
kitchen,
bed.
The boiler room.
That is bedroom. Like yeah. One of the only parts of the Nusscum we know about, aside from like from point A to point B
right.
through the kitchen.
And the ballroom is the
really
one
doesn't describe much of the ship. You
not
just
really.
Imagine some sort of
yeah.
like restaurant.
It's
kitchen.
The ballroom is the most described part of the book. And that's because it's the beginning of the book, and it's the central point for that part. So it's beautifully done.
Well, it's almost a central point for the story, too, in the fact that it skips around realities
yeah.
and goes to different worlds.
The most notable part of the Nusscum were the people.
Yeah, mm-hmm. and that was...
Yeah, the people made the ship.
So when it comes to the world building of that, Frayn gave us the perfect amount of, here's the description of the ballroom, or jail, or whatever. And it's like, here's the people that populate it. Which you will find far more interesting. And as Summerhill, or, over watching through Summerhill's eyes, you care more about the people around you than the actual architecture. Because, quite frankly, if any of us were on that ship, we would be staring at the aliens rather than, look at that gilded ceiling.
The ship is really inconsequential.
When we were on the cruise ship, we were looking at all the strange people versus the cruise ship itself. I mean... We did eventually look at the cruise ship, but it was all the strange people, and let's face it, they're the same species, and we're still going...
Oh, it's the same. My friends and I, you could go for coffee. You'll see the coffee shop or whatever, and that only takes about 5 minutes to take in. After that, what's the next most interesting thing?
The
people going in.
The
and
hipsters
that's
with their computers,
you
writing
start,
their
Well,
novels.
You start people watching, right?
Yes.
Yeah, you can look at a landscape, and you can, for the most part, you take a glance, and you know where you are. At that point, it's the things that make up the landscape and the world, which are the people, they're the cultural differences, it's a lot more than strictly just what you see. Which is why the Nusscum was so vivid in its description, is because it had such a wide variety, interesting set of people.
It's just like the port where it was built. Where it was set mm-hmm. of, here's this planet, here's this dock, here's Summerhill sitting on the dock, and this nebula below him. And it's just the descriptions of it, it's like, it's just the right amount of for you to visualize it and then let your imagination take over. So, since we've talked about the landscape...
Well, every world he went to
would
start with usually a vivid picture of what he saw, followed by the people he would see or interact with afterwards.
I think the ice planet was the only one where it was...
Well, even still, because after he walks out, he goes down, and I think he sees someone go into the house? Or did he walk up to the house and see them in there?
I think he saw the house.
But there was smoke coming out of the house or something, and he approached the house and looked in the window.
And I guess even then, the characters were more interesting than the actual setting itself.
And because of how the story was was presented and laid out, each world that he went to had to be so outlandish, so different... And vivid because he's this time traveling dimension.
Well, to be fair, that's the interest for things like Doctor Who and Sliders, which are the inspiration for this book. Because that's, it's like even Like Jan and I watching Doctor Who for the first time, it's like, well, what's the most amazing thing? Well, it's like, well, starting from the reboot, it's like, okay, well, here they are on Earth. At first place they go, end of Earth. And it's, and of course, there's the setting, which is literally one room for the most part with all these different alien characters. And it's like, well, what's the most interesting part of that? Well, this very bland setting with all these unique characters, which
you,
is...
It makes me think you would probably like the Centaurans.
I like British sci-fi because on a small budget, British sci-fi knows where to concentrate their efforts. And the fact is you compare that to, say, American sci-fi, and it's all about the effects and the computer generations and how big and monstrous can we do that.
Well, we see that right now in the movies industry. It's like nobody does set building anymore. It's all on the computer, and you're spending... Well, like Interstellar, there's... All the reviews I'm hearing of it are all, look how pretty it is, look how great it is, look how shiny it is, but there's no character development. There's not much focus on the character's trip. It's just the focus on the trip.
Another thing I kind of want to point out, because we've mentioned Summerhill and Doctor Who and these kinds of shows mm-hmm. as our examples for great world building. Think of... They have such a wide canvas to draw their story on because... When you don't really have to limit yourself to the bounds of what is reality,
see,
you have a lot to work with.
Yeah, and that's where I find my problems with historical fiction. Like with The Last Kajak, I had to really stay within a certain parameter of reality.
And
whereas with, you know, with The Black Spot, I could be like, I do whatever the fuck I want!
But at the same time, when you're presented with that much choice, it's so difficult to... I find myself overwhelmed with choice.
Yeah, because you're starting from scratch. You're like, well, I could do this, but it'll affect your character this way, right?
Well, not. I don't think we're talking about the same thing quite, because when, like, I'm trying a hand at the time dimension whatever traveler story. Yeah, I know. Because
this
now
is
I
why
have...
when he suggested we do
well,
something
no,
like that, I was like,
people,
I don't want to do that.
Okay, the thing is like, the time travel aspect... Sorry to cut you off. The time travel aspect of it... Okay, yeah, I have my hate on for time travel, but the dimensional travel aspect of it has that potential and has that ability for you to do the world building.
But yeah, like when you're doing something like that, though, like what I'm finding to be the most difficult part right now is that I'm paralyzed by choice. There's
too many options?
Yeah.
Which
way
do you go?
I have so many ways to take something that I don't know which way to go. It's like... walking into just this place and the menu is like 200 items long and you just don't know where to start.
So let's go off of our thing here. How deep should you go when it comes to world building?
I love doing it myself.
How deep are you comfortable going?
Well, because the thing is, we've all read those books where it's here's the amount of world building and it just goes on and on and on. Take
Some
The Hobbit,
that,
take
though.
Lord of the Rings. Yeah, some people love it. Some people want to hear...
Some people need it.
Yeah, some people do need it.
Well, that's what made the Clan of the Cave Bear series so popular, was her world building. It's technically historical fiction, but she is world building. And everyone, people love it. Well,
by
it's
that
like
same...
The Cimmerillion?
Oh,
from Tolkien?
Yeah.
That's
yeah,
world
yeah.
building, and people just eat that.
By the same token, it's what stops a lot of people from actually writing. The term paralysis by analysis is common just for that reason.
I think
you get too stuck in the world building.
I think it's mostly because a lot of people, when they hear about these great authors, like Martin and Tolkien, like, look at the research material Tolkien had when he wrote all of his books. I mean, there was, there's drawers and drawers and maps, and he had the moon phases, and he had every...
He had been working on it for so long.
Oh, yeah, and the thing is that, yeah, like, it's easily... It's easy for a new writer to come in and look at that and be like, well, I'm supposed to do that too.
Well, a lot of people's
not.
Passions don't carry them that far.
That's true.
So it's like when we were in Seattle and we went down to the museum, we saw Jim Henson's books there with all of his world planning and his character planning, and he had a fair bit even for how old those movies were.
I think the whole thing about building these great, vast worlds is that I know he's kind of the... staple for a lot of examples, but you know, if we just look inside the fandom and look at the stuff that Kyle Gold has written,
mm-hmm.
a lot of the books that he's like, well, a lot of the worlds that he now has are the result of the books he wrote before these worlds were really a thing. So you write your worlds, and the more that you write in these worlds, the bigger your world becomes. So it starts out very basic, and then it flourishes into something much, much larger.
Well, and that the same thing happens with like Dan Abnett's Gaunt's Ghost series within the Warhammer 40K universe. He started off writing a trilogy, which then turned into multiple trilogies. But in it, it was just the amount every book led onto something else and led into an evolution. And little things that he would put in those first few books evolved further. And you get that a lot with people who end up writing a series that extends longer, is that they end up having little hooks in their first few books that are planted there. Like I'm guilty of doing the same thing. It's one thing that drives Ray Chan crazy, is I will see these little hooks into things, and then as I write further, they just evolve. I've got, for example, Holly and Raven from my Taboo story, Red Panda Girls, is now branched into the upcoming Willy Alpha 2 anthology and Willy Alpha 3. And things that I seeded into that first book unconsciously are now building this world that they live in, and all these relationships. And even little things that I put in the first one tie into other works that I've written. So it's just slowly I'm building upon this world, but that's because it's short stories. You don't have a lot of space to build in short stories. If they're novels.
Kind of the funny thing about what you're talking about is like building short stories into short stories into short stories is that I have not felt the inclination to do that. Every single story that I, not every single one, but most of the stories that I write are worlds separate from their own.
Mm-hmm.
I think mostly because like writing for anthologies and short stories is a bit of a sort of like a proving ground.
But if you go back and you look at like one of your stories and reread it, thinking about if I had to write another story set in this world, where would I go? I bet you would find those hooks that you're unintentionally seeding through it.
Well, yeah, and once you've written a short story, or any story, really, and you decide, you're like, oh, I want to put this in the same world. Yeah, it's your story's there. It is so easy for you to go back and be like, oh, I'm gonna put that little fish hook here. You can thread it into your story, and then just, you're off.
Mark?
As you keep saying hooks, and I keep imagining like these literal fish hooks like sinking into your story, and like
in the book Now Write, specifically the one for writing in genres horror, fantasy, science fiction, one of the things in there that they came up for were helping to build worlds. The example that was given by the person who wrote the article was she wrote this beautiful science fiction story. It was one of her first ones. She was really, really proud of it. She took it to a workshop. And where one of her favorite science fiction authors was running it, he took one look at it, handed it back to her, and said, no, this doesn't work. And she's like, why? And he's like, the world is unrealistic. And she's like, why? And he sat there and explained about the fact that her monetary system does not work. And the example, or the exercise they give in that article is, where does the money go? The easiest way to world build, especially if you're going for longer works, is to take a look at the world that you're building and track how your economy works. Because if you don't have a believable economy, most people are going to start feeling, well, this is... Take Next Generation.
Okay.
In Next Generation, money does not exist, at least in the Federation.
And I remember growing up as a kid asking Mom, how do they pay for everything?
And the thing is they talk about gold pressed platinum being used as income between the Federation and everyone else, and all this is kind of the uninformed. But as a person living in the Federation, you have everything that you ever want provided for you. It's kind of like the ultimate communist government. But that's unrealistic, because the real world doesn't work like that.
No.
If you have everything provided for you, where is your motivation to work?
You have to be motivated by passion, and let's face it, nobody wants to do a fast food joint.
Why?
Shut up, Wesley.
Now, to be fair, there's a world with replicators and all that, so you don't have furniture builders and all that you know, build materials to sell to other people.
Yeah, that's okay. That's true.
But then,
I'd never actually considered that line of thinking in Star Trek, and now I'm really wondering why all those people work on that ship.
But that's it's well, they do it to explore. They do it, to, but the thing is
but,
that you
but
have.
But half of those people working on the ship never go anywhere but in space to work on that
but
ship.
By that same token, all of those people are very passionate.
Now you know why all the red shirts die.
Except Worf.
They have no.
Except for Worf.
They have no will to live.
Died a couple times.
Yeah. There's an away mission. I'm a red shirt. I'm tired of working on this stupid nacelle every day of my life.
Yeah, it's like, okay, Wesley Crusher, or Wesley Crusher is the same person, isn't he?
Yes, he is.
Yes.
Wesley, Worf, Deanna. Okay, we need two red shirts.
Come down to the planet. I'm bored. I want to see new things.
Here, hold this defective blaster.
You, go first.
But... Yeah. As I said, once you view it from that standpoint, the entire world that it lives in falls apart. Now, you take what's a good one? It's a good science fiction thing. I was going to use Blade Runner, but that's
it depends what you're trying to.
Yeah, it depends on
the
example.
It's where the money goes. Kind of deal to use where it was like you look at a world building that actually does it properly.
Let's look at
like
Repo.
Repo the Genetic Opera, I hope, right? Okay.
Yeah. No, Repo Men.
I wonder where the money comes from in that one, too. Let's.
But I was less of a fan of that movie.
Yeah.
Yes.
But, you know, you have
Repo the Genetic Opera.
I liked it.
Where they explain the situation that's happened and everything that has rushed in to fill that economic void. And therein is your plot.
What's interesting there, too, though, is there's almost two different kinds of currency. You have money.
Yeah.
And then you have Zydrate.
And hookers. Gotta have
hookers. Hookers do appear to be a legitimate form of currency in Repo.
In any time period ever.
Well, they exist, but are they legitimate? They're actually legitimate in Repo, whereas, you know, like, right now, they're not legitimate.
They're just like, and hookers. I'll pay you in hookers.
I will pay you
and
in bitches.
That just seems okay.
Before I go into a discussion about hookers in Star Trek and where they fit in the economy.
They're called counselors. One of the first things.
No, you don't have to explain it, really.
Most of them are paid for with Riker's time, though.
Yeah, that's true. Riker or Worf, depending on where you are in the series.
Worf. I'll buy that. Worf.
Regardless. But hey. You take Repo and you have, and I mean, right there, you can world build solely based off the economy. You can build a realistic situation and a plot line for your story just by thinking about how your economy sets up. Like, I will admit, I look at some of my stories and the economy doesn't really play a factor, but that's because they're set in modern times. You take my Dungeon Grind story. And it's your typical fantasy economy where it's like, yes, they mine for minerals, which they trade, which is openly discussed in the book. Plus, there's also all the monsters they slay, which they sell and whatnot.
Now, there's that brings up an interesting point because we've talked about the inverse of this, where you essentially remove the complications of a lot of everyday life by removing money in the first place. You have all of these characters that get to focus on other things because they don't have money. So how do you think that fits into the philosophy of where does the money go?
Well, it depends on how you handle it. I'm trying to think of how money was handled in Summerhill.
Money was kind of irrelevant.
Yeah, I don't think money was brought up.
Because the Nusquam was a VIP, like, invite-only
ship.
Yeah,
so you were provided.
Where no money was necessary. The worlds that he goes to, money is not a concept.
When he visited the world with the Otter, everything was pretty much... They're self-sufficient. There's a town nearby. They worked and
ate. Yeah, people work because they have to live.
Yeah.
But then you have stories where the characters have so much money that you make it very pointless to have money because there's so much of it.
And that's a relevant way of doing it. Because
like inflation would be huge in most of the furry stories I've read.
Mm.
Yeah. But in doing that, you do relieve that worry of trying to figure out how to handle the monetary situation. Same thing with a lot of, say, erotica, where it's set in present time. And once it's set in present time, everyone automatically assumes that they have a day job, they do their own thing, and or they don't give a shit because that's not where the story's concentrating. But again, short stories versus novels. Novels, you have to kind of figure that stuff out.
Okay, well, like, as far as, you know, where the money goes in the story that I wrote for Taboo, one of the characters' main motivations is, not main motivations, but one of their stronger motivations is money. It's why they do a lot of the things that they do, and they have no shame in doing it.
That was your first Taboo story, right?
Did I write a second one?
Yeah,
you did. Sorry. I'm thinking Trick or Treat in my head.
Oh,
yes. No, you're right. And yeah, and because that worked.
You know, as a character, she needs money, and that's part of her development as well, is that her need for money is what defines her as a character.
Yeah. So I guess the takeaway from all of this chat is that
your mileage may vary.
Your mileage may vary, but if you're stuck on how to build your world, one of the things you might want to do is sit down and think about how your economy works.
And if gas costs $1.40 a liter, then your mileage may vary less.
Yeah. So we've talked about the economy of things. As we're all furry writers, world building within the furry universe. I've already stated that it's an important thing. It as important as actually making your furry character furry. There are certain things in a furry world that you have to take into account because you're no longer just a world of humans, you're a world of anthros, and there's certain things that you have to take into account when you deal with that.
See, and I do like doing that. That's probably one of my favorite things about world building with the furry world is you have to take things into account, like they've got fur, they've got claws, they've got, you know, extra smell, senses, hearing. I liked doing that juxtaposition with the furry future where he wanted the human and the furry integration in the world. And I liked doing that. That's why I chose a marketing theme. I mean, because I work kind of closely with the marketing group in my company, and it would just be fascinating to think of, like, suddenly if you were actually a Tigrox, what kind of specifics you would need for just day-to-day life. I mean, your underwear wouldn't even work anymore, for Christ's sake, because you've got a tail now.
You don't know anything about my underwear.
Well, I'm assuming you wear it like everybody else, but in the winter, at least.
You also have wings.
And you also have wings, not to mention you've got, you know...
Where?
How, you'd never be able to wear headphones again. Not those ones, at least.
Actually,
my pictures prove you wrong.
Okay, yeah. The wing thing, the fact that they are reptilian / bat-like
they're
wings.
They're vestigial, and...
Well, if you're out in the cold, you would have to protect them because you would lose so much heat and you have the chance of frostbite.
That's
in
why
the
most
webbing.
People will talk about folding wings.
Consider
well, and then there's also just the
so
hind,
I have issues
feet
with people
claws.
Like that have dragon characters that just slip a hoodie on.
Yeah,
and then like stretch their wings and you're like,
what? No, exactly. Like that's one of my favorite things about world building with furries.
Well, I mean, like, just consider the fact that if you were a furry character, you would have so much fur.
You wouldn't
and so,
need much, yeah.
Like, likely you wouldn't even need clothes. Like, who's to say you're wearing underwear because you're full of fur? Who's to say you need a hoodie because you're full of fur? And, you know, even if you had wings, as improbable as it might be, that you wouldn't really have to worry about getting... You'd have to worry about knocking shit over. But
seriously,
maybe,
what
maybe
wings
not
are you talking
about,
guys? I don't know what you're talking about.
Skirts in winter.
But...
This
that's why I always like the question of what things would not exist in a furry world that do exist now because of, you know, like
vacuums. Yes, I actually had to put that into the book. Well, because you tried to vacuum. I mean, dogs are trying to attack the vacuum. Our cats just lose their shit and run away. It's like we're trying to destroy them. It's like the commercial says, you know, the vacuum, it screams and sucks at the same time.
Baths are probably going to be less popular. Showers are going to be definitely more popular because it's just...
Soaps.
Sitting
but
in
how,
a tub with your entire all that fur.
All I can think of is putting a fur suit in the
getting out of the tub would be the most the hardest thing ever to do. It's
well,
like
you
yes,
wonder,
I'm a sheepdog. Let me sit in the tub.
You
oh might, God, I can't get out.
You might not even have baths. You might have like a communal pool or something where people actually go to wash instead.
You might do a chinchilla. Oh no, all that fur. Ew. Okay, maybe
of course, better thought out than that. But
chinchilla dry baths. Because the dry shampooing is pretty popular from humans.
I'm going to use a Kyle example here, and I've talked about this before. Green Fairy. You have the wolves living in the stone house because it contains their scent. It feels very den-like. It makes them feel secure and safe. Then you have the otters who have managed to turn their house into essentially interconnected pools. As expensive, retardedly expensive as that would be, very otter-like.
Otterly fitting.
Oh. Those are two ways of approaching the whole thing, where it was like when you're world building your characters. That said, those were the only two aspects, and it made me kind of wonder about the wider world of things and how they would end up dealing with things. One of the things I was thinking about with the furry world building is it's much along the same lines of you're into the same thing in fantasy or science fiction, especially take the Na'vi. Their world is very much built around their attributes, how they deal with things, and it's clearly not how the humans deal with things. Same thing happens with, say, elves or dwarves, classic elves, classic dwarves, classic orcs. They each have the way that they do things that are very distinctly them. Their tropes, true. And you get some of the best stuff when you end up having your orcs that don't behave like orcs and your dwarves that don't behave like dwarves, so on and so forth.
Like, a lot of the furry world, like, a lot of the effective furry world building happens when there is such a stark contrast to what already exists today. Like, so much furry fiction's written in the sense that, like, we have a world very much like our own, but we're all furry. And, you know, if you think about the fact that that wouldn't happen,
mm-hmm.
you wouldn't have mixed races milling about everywhere. Not right away. And you would have, like, you know, Ireland would be, like, the sheepdogs, and you'd have all the dingoes down in Australia and New Zealand, and, like, that kind of thing.
That said, dingoes aren't native to Australia. They're actually dogs that were brought over by settlers.
Okay, so maybe the dingoes are the convicts that get sent to Australia.
Oh. Yeah,
there you
that.
Go.
It's so, Roland's idea. You guys can't steal it.
Copyrighted, patent pending. But
that's why they got deported.
Yeah, they ate all the babies.
But, like, it's... One thing to try to write furry and you'd be like, oh, dogs are afraid of vacuums, but vacuums wouldn't exist, of course.
Well, you also think that they would by then get used to it.
Or they would be used to it, like...
Or there'd be more development into making it, you know,
a lot
less
of the,
horrible.
A lot of the focus is putting, like, giving them animal characteristics, but...
The dice...
There also needs to be an equal amount of focus into making them human.
Yeah.
And making sure that they evolve as a human-like species would.
Mm-hmm.
And part of the problem is you have dozens.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, you'd have a bunch of pandas in, like, China or...
Pandas would... I'm sorry, that's way off topic. I was going to go on a panda rant, but let's not.
Let me tell you about anatomically correct pandas.
No. It was more along the lines
cats
of...
Cats have barbs on their penises.
Pandas are so friggin' fragile.
Have you ever tried to lick honey off a person's body? Your tongue would be so tight. Okay, I'm sorry, I'm done.
So...
I don't think people give a lot of thought to that kind of furry world building.
True. I think...
I do.
Much like anything, as we've stated already a couple times in this podcast, concentrate on the things that your character are interacting with, things that are relevant, especially with the furry universe. If your character has a shower, you're probably going to want to mention how they dried off. You don't have to.
And you know why having a shower in a furry world would be an awful idea? You know how you clog your drain now?
Yeah.
Me and Nova. Like,
oh, I know.
It would just be horrible. Like think of all the fur we get when we just have to wash licorice a little
bit. Indoor plumbing might very well not exist. Or it would never be used to wash your appendages. You need
some sort of filter beforehand.
Yeah, like a filter, some sort of fur remover, like a garburator for your shower. Which would be
hilarious.
It could be a very handy tool in, you know, any one of your horror stories, boys.
Come on, honey, are you done the shower? Just about. Okay, drain's clean.
Every drain would have a carburetor.
Good God.
Plumbers would be the gods of that civilization because they would...
Groomers.
No, plumbers wouldn't have hands.
You're...
There'd be so many WCB claims, like.
But things like stylists.
Well, dog groomers right now are pretty freaking popular.
But the fact is you're dealing with someone who is 6 feet tall, and has to, you know, and they want to get groomed. That's going to take a lot more time than a standard haircut.
Imagine the amount of garbage bags you would need.
I can't brush my own ass. Someone save me.
Think of like some of the more deranged, like some of the breeds that have to get themselves cut, or else like they
have
any amount of excrement stuck in their fur. Like,
let's not even
go with that.
That wasn't route. Really where I meant to go with that. But
the days
you have animals that can't take care of themselves.
Wows.
Yeah. So like, they probably wouldn't exist. You wouldn't have selective breeding. You wouldn't have like these Dobermans or German Shepherds. You would have African wild dogs. You would have
that'd be whatever. Really awkward to try and do a breeding program, wouldn't it?
Like, yeah, you would. It would be Germany would have to have all the purebreds.
Okay. So we're gonna, let's steer back on the topic.
This is on topic. You just don't want it to lead in this direction.
We're not exactly helping people write, though. We're going on rants about things that don't or do exist.
Okay.
Yeah, that's why I've had my hand up.
Yes.
Well, I've to be fair, I've been doing that for a while, too.
So why don't we already see this in stories?
Nobody's done
it. Same. I think it's the same reason
needs to be first.
Does it actually need to be done?
Not if you don't want to.
The community seems to be fine with it as it is. The bare minimum of, oh, well, this is how they dry off a little bit faster.
Well, I mean, there's a level of thought that doesn't necessarily have to go into that kind of world building, but...
I mean, all this that you've been discussing for the last 15 minutes, there's a level of thought that doesn't need to be going into it.
But here's the thing, is that I don't see why not this kind of level of world building.
I think it goes back to the same thing of why don't we write our characters going to the bathroom.
Because that's icky and nobody wants to read.
Well, that's not necessarily.
That's
needed.
A little bit. That's a little bit different. Like everybody.
I don't think you're. Yes, but so if you're going to go into that level of detail of what's going on or how this works, then you might as well explain
why
they.
That's not a fair comparison.
Why not?
If I'm going to write that level of detail into a story, I can't just go this because that. I can't just gloss over that kind of detail.
That's a straw man argument.
If I'm going to introduce that level of detail of world building into a furry story, that's not just a small gloss overable process.
Except that it's been done.
As I said, I think certain things need to, basically, if your character's interacting with something, then you kind of need to sort of explain it. I think that you don't see it a lot in fiction now. The same reason that you don't see a lot of people doing furry characters as furry characters is that they have these tools and a lot of them maybe don't want to use them, don't know how to use them, and are basically don't realize that people who are really good at doing this, i.e. like Kyle Gold, are as good as they are because they use these tools. And that's what makes it a much more realistic and engaging story for people who are fans of anthropomorphic characters, because it makes you feel like you're in an anthropomorphic character world.
Because they add in those little details?
Yes.
So like, let's take, for example, an example we used before, which is the steak. You know, do you need to explain where that steak came from? Can you have a cow character serve your wolf a steak?
There's a level of... I think
Because there have been stories where people just sit down, they eat a steak, and they walk away, and there's nothing pertaining to where that steak came from, why anyone finds it weird, what's going on, and most of the stories just seem to go, yep, just, you know, suspension of disbelief, done.
My favorite excuse for that was done by a gentleman named Troy Denning, who wrote a five-book series in the Dark World series. I've never found anything else of his. Really good read, but in the world he's created, a lot of multi-species, it's bugs. Their mounts are bugs. Their food source is bugs. The different types of delicacies, different types of raised animals, it's...
But that's all incorporated into the world.
It's all incorporated into the world, and he explains it as he writes. You know, like, you know, your opening scene is this character riding a clank mount. And then after a couple more sentences, you learned what a clank is, and then you find out that there's more bugs, like the halflings prefer this bug, but the halflings worship this bug, but that bug's eaten by the mules, and it's really lovely done, and I've always loved going to that default with a furry world is bugs.
And the thing is I kind of did the same thing with one of my taboo stories, Scent of Heaven, where in two lines of text, Dad brought us back from the insect zoo. We pet a giant stag beetle. How dare you do that? Oh, we got to ride the carousel, essentially, but with insects. In three lines, I have stated how the entire ecology works on that planet in three sentences, and that's it. I don't mention it at all for the rest of it, but I've also cleared that problem right there.
I think part of the problem with this as well is that, like, it's very easy for people to destroy the suspension of disbelief in a lot of stories because it's so easy to connect with other people. You have these... Before I actually had the opportunity to talk with other people, like, on such a wide scale about these kinds of aspects in world building and stories, I never thought about it. You know, people like to make fun of, you know, it's now a sort of a trope to make fun of movies for shooting too many bullets or for taking a shot in the arm. Like, people are becoming very educated about what
arrow in the knee,
you know, what is supposed to be real and what's not, and that it is destroying their suspension of disbelief, and now you have to be that much more accurate or else people aren't going to be taken away by your story. And, you know, that's just to sort of touch on the level of furry world building that we were talking about earlier. Maybe that's the next step. Maybe we do think about, you know, what other level we can take world building to. Just because somebody hasn't done it before doesn't mean that you shouldn't consider it.
I would be curious as to see if you had a world that, if you do put that level into, where you do end up, you know, having that almost hyper detail, what the response would be in having something done. That said, it couldn't be in a short story. It would have to be in a novel format.
I think part of the reason that somebody hasn't done it yet is because that is a very complex way of building your world.
It's an extremely complex way of building the world. And there might, and the thing is you might get, you know, praised solely based on the fact that you did that alone, plot being good or
you
otherwise.
Never get praised for doing something complicated poorly.
That's no, true. You'd think that you'd at least get a kudos for attempting, but no.
But, like, doing things like that is difficult, and if you don't do it well, then people aren't going to recognize the effort you put into it.
Yeah.
And so it's not surprising that not a lot of people have put that much detail into whatever it is they're writing.
But yeah, in all seriousness, I would like to see someone come up with a Tolkien amount of detail and just see what the response would be if someone actually did that. Because I think it would be interesting. I personally...
Are people already doing that right now?
I don't know anyone who is. I think the person who puts the most into the world building right now...
What do you mean that no one is right now?
I don't think anyone's putting, like...
I would totally disagree with that. I think there are lots of people out there who are building worlds that big
either A, we haven't seen them yet, or yeah. B, there we already have like R.R. Martin.
No, but I mean in Furry.
Oh, in Furry.
No. Yeah. Outside of Furry, and people have done that. Like hard science fiction does it continually. But in
that sort of goes back to what we were talking about, people building worlds so big that they never actually write.
Like, I think, like, I personally am not a fan of the people who put that much detail into it. I just find them to be cumbersome. But that's also why I don't read hard sci-fi. Well, there are people out there that will pick up hard sci-fi and friggin' orgasm everywhere because they know the science behind it, and they just like, wow, this presents all these things that deal with, you know, all these new cutting edge sciencey things, and I love it.
Yeah, like I like a lot of stories that just let you fill in the details, or the details aren't overt. They're baked into the narrative. They're baked into the characters' actions or the people around them.
I like world building where you get the taste of it. You get that appetizer of the world, the larger world, and it makes you want more.
You love doing that.
I like doing that in my stories. I like reading it in other stories.
Well, you were just talking to me on the way over here about you're reading this book with the world building, and he throws Easter eggs in there constantly, and you love it.
Tim Wagner. He wrote the Michael Richter series. He wrote it in a time before the paranormal genre became popular. But in it, it's basically the concept is there's an alternate dimension where all the monsters of the world went. And the world's divided into these certain spokes and certain areas. So you have this area that's all demons. You have this area that's all magic users. You have this area that's all the undead and reanimated. And he did a beautiful job building this world. And every page is crammed with these interesting situations and things that he's pulled from all these different sources. And then on top of that, he puts Easter eggs from horror films in there. Like, there's one point where I was explaining they're walking through the underworld's dungeon, and there's this, he's drawn to look over to where this crying girl is. They stop and he looks over, and it's this crying girl in a cage with long wet black hair, and the warden is like, don't mind her, she just can't let go of her grudges. And it's like, oh, but it's so just a blah mention, but it's still so friggin' amazing that you're like, awesome. And they're all over the place in this book, but it's one of those cases where he's just jammed so much world building into here, and it's as interesting, if not more interesting, than the actual plot of the series.
See, I'm horrible at world building. I never use enough description in my
okay.
works.
See, well,
I love doing description works.
Yes.
Like, my world building will be like one small paragraph, or and then one here, and then a few things of what the people are doing. But most of the time, I'm like, "What's happening right now? What's this person saying? Where is it going?" I'm always so very plot driven.
Well, that's one of the hardest things that I find about world building is that I'm so wrapped up in what my characters are doing that it's hard to be like,
yeah.
"Oh, look at this beautiful scenery!" Like, it's like sort of like in a movie. You're never, unless it's like the panning, like beautiful sunset kind of thing. You're never looking at the scenery. You're always looking
Lord
at these,
of the Rings does that lot.
These characters. You're always looking at the people interacting or
but see for
thing that's happening.
For me, when I write longer stories that aren't porn, the setting is actually as important to me as are the characters.
It absolutely is.
And for me, it's like my Blood and Roses story. You start off learning about one of the characters. He's leading this girl from the bar back into the house. They walk into his home, and there's giant vases everywhere filled with
thick roses.
And it's like
that, those really big blooms with like the giant headed ones.
And it's
so
essentially
perfumey.
A
yeah.
3 or 4 story tall building that's being hollowed out, and they walk into the front thing and it's like, what the hell? And there's just all these roses everywhere. But then if you look up in the shadows, there's these giant cable-thick spider webs everywhere. and you're like, the fuck is going on? And then you find out the next, because he kills her, and then you go to the next day, and then
she's like, in the
cannibalism.
When it comes to trying to write good world building, I mean, like, there's a reason that my, like, all of my short stories have notes. I'm like, you know, this person really should have some animal traits, or this scene really should contain this, and like, it's a lot like trying to plant Easter eggs in your novel. I can't just write it. I have to go back and edit this stuff in.
And there's also also dependent on what genre you're writing in. Take Abandoned Places. Friggin' Abandoned Places itself is set around the world building, essentially.
Abandoned Places might have been one of my stronger world building.
You
stories.
Did a very, and you, oh, yeah, it is. It was, nicely it was and it was like that for a
which
lot
is
of stories.
Funny because
there.
The entire story was pretty much based around the house and then the occupants in it.
Yes.
But that's still the world. That's where
well,
you
yeah,
want
the
reader
world,
to focus.
The
that's
world
as far
is the
as,
house.
Yeah.
I mean, the same thing happened with in my Piping, which is where it's you're in the Arctic and you've got these old destroyed crawlers, but then you also have the new ones and people are kind of like, well, this team was doomed, but we're making camp at the same place that they did.
Don't mind the old decrepit Indian bones.
I like and that, and with Abandoned Places, a lot of the settings I remember more than I remember the characters themselves. The steamboat in Yanis's story, the decrepit ship in one of the other ones. There was your house. Friggin', there was.
What's the what, the cover?
Oh,
Under the Mountain.
Under the Mountain.
Yeah.
Where it's like that one, friggin' the world building. Like
the one with the tunnels underneath the ground.
That's Under the Mountain.
No, there's Under the Mountain. That was the sci-fi one. There was the mine one.
Yeah.
Oh, where
that,
the guy
that
the...
one was one of the most like.
With the ghosts.
Creepy,
yeah, ghosts.
Like world.
But even.
Settings.
And one day you too can join in this discussion. But for now, you're sitting on the side for me, with like me until MFF when it comes out.
Sorry.
But take, I'm going to use Under the Mountain in the regards of for world building. Because look at how he handled it. You have three characters in spacesuits. They're clearly on another planet. They work for a corporation, the mining corporation. They're clearly trying to find, you know, one of them found an entrance to something else. You immediately know from the setting, you know, they're miners, or the world building, they're miners, it's obviously a corporation-run mining gig, they're looking for ores, and there's clearly stuff here that have been left behind and whatnot. Horror relies a lot on world building to set the mood and the atmosphere and all the things for that. If you're just writing, say, erotica, that's a little harder to do, because the people are there for the fap. They're not necessarily there for, oh, that's a beautiful world you've constructed. I really like the way that you did, you know, this.
I
and
can't
it makes
fap
me...
to scenery.
Like, the bit that you mentioned about horror, like, world building being one of horror's strongest traits, because there are so many stories that just... it's hard for me to get into horror, because I look at so many stories, so many plots that... just aren't intriguing. They're not built properly. But if you have a proper setting in a proper like horror scenario, then they are absolutely chilling.
I might have a book for you, by the way.
Oh,
I have to finish reading it first.
Okay.
Well, it's to go on the erotica statement. Taking, as I was talking earlier, I'm writing more and more stories set in the universe of Red Panda Girls. And the first story that I wrote, the one in Taboo, it's like, okay, there's not really a lot said about the world itself. It's just these minor details. And then I wrote the second one where they're on a cruise ship and more comes out. And the third one, I'm being forced as I write these to now look at it from an actual world building perspective and actually having to build this world, because as opposed to one story, a one-off story, I am now doing these regular characters who people are going to be able to read from story to story to story following them. And the world that they're in has to be created, because I no longer can just sit there and be like, oh, it's a erotica story. I don't need a world. No, now I need that world. I need to populate it so that I can actually write more stories set in it.
One of the kinds of genres that I've really been getting more into writing lately are the very whimsical stories. And those stories are so much more than just the characters and their interactions. You need this grand, like, vast world that is just the trying to recreate the feeling of, like, your tingling sensation when you're anticipating something that you know is going to be good. And if your world falls flat, that's just not going to work at all.
Exactly.
Hi, guys. From Candle. You said quick, so here's quick. Unedited response. This might be a little more raw than I'd normally write if I had the chance to edit my thoughts more carefully, but here goes. World building is one of those things that I constantly hear experienced writers say people are doing too much. I wholeheartedly disagree. I read novice stories, and I'm constantly struck by how many clear shortcuts people take with their worlds that end up horribly stunting the story. That's not the mark of an over-designed world. It's the mark of an under-designed one. Even if people got their world-building wrong, you'd see more of a mark on their story than what you normally see in a common fare of literature. The problem isn't the time or effort spent on it, but the way that especially novice writers enshrine their first ideas when designing their world. They don't have the experience to know that whatever their first instinct is, it's probably wrong. It probably won't suit their story. Even if it's neat, even if it's unique, even if it's just your fucking darling, if it doesn't suit the story, it has to go. The world that many writers create are flawed, not because they spend too much time or too little time, but because they care too much about their neat ideas and don't think about how it's going to affect the narrative. World building, just like every other part of the story, is there to serve the plot. The world is a damn useful tool. You can use it to drive the plot, enhance atmosphere, explain character eccentricities, and set your audience in the right mindset for the story, even without the characters present. But the moment that the world starts to detract from the story, I say it's the world that has to change. If novice writers are looking to take away anything from my opinion here, it's to go as wild as they want with their worlds, fall in love with them, live a few lives in them, and then, when they're smitten, get ready to take out the hacksaw and start lopping your beloved apart, because it's a tight, compelling narrative is king. Just some foxy thoughts. Not everyone feels that way. Fuck, look at Avatar with their Super Smurf Pocahontas ripoffs. It made millions, but you know what? Take away the effects and you got a pretty cliche, shitty story. And since your world isn't being rendered by industrial light and magic and directed by James Cameron, let's worry about making a compelling story first, eh? Condrel. I didn't realize he was Canadian.
Now I feel bad about using Avatar as an example.
After you've watched Avatar, then go watch The Last Airbender.
Well, no, it's Avatar is the last of the Pocahontas Mohican Smurfs or something like that. No, last of the Pocahontas Mohican Smurfs in Fern Gully. Yeah, it's one of the horrible things I've heard it called.
So I think
that's actually a very valid point because, and we touched on it briefly at the beginning, where you have all these novice writers who come in and they, as I said, like look at the Tolkien or Martin and go, I have to build this giant world first before I can populate it. And it's like, you don't really need to. You can, but when it comes down to your novel, you may not use even 75% to 90% of what you've written down.
I think most of the people that I've seen write these like great big worlds for all of their characters to frolic around in, I don't think I've seen a single one that's actually completed their story.
Mm.
But let's say that someone has, they're still not at the point where they realize that regardless of how much they're in love with their world, that it can't stay as is. They have to edit it. They have to hack and slash at the fluff until they get down to the nitty gritty of their world, the good part. I mean, it'd be like eating the rind on an orange.
Well, we've all read those stories where it's just you take a step back and you're like, why did I just read, you know, 6 pages on this meal? Perfect example, now that I've thought about this, Princess Bride. Because the book reads a lot in parts like the movie does. And one part of the book, and unfortunately I haven't read it, but I had a person point this out to me, is the guy who's doing the story goes, you know, to this point where she is packing. And then he goes, what follows here is 5 pages of everything that Princess so-and-so is packing for this trip. I am not going to talk about it here because, you know, clearly it's not an interesting. And then he goes back into the story. But you do have stories like that.
Where they'll describe
it. And he's just, and he's just making fun of that fact, where it's like, I mean, there's a 40K novel written back in the 70s or 80s where they talk about this beautiful meal that's laid out and there's fetal whale carcass and there's this and that and the other. Does it play any part in the story? No. Does it create anything for the atmosphere? No. Why? Because they're there to talk about what they're going to do that's going to continue on the plot, and that's what you give a shit about.
Don't we just call that dead flavor text? Things that people have thrown in there to try and build up their word count, and it really has nothing to do with the story itself.
Isn't that just what flavor text is, though?
Yeah, well, sometimes flavor text can give you a bit of more of an insight into the world, but with that specific example, that doesn't do anything.
A furry example. Save the day. A lot of the material in there is world building that is unnecessary. You have superheroes that show up or are mentioned. I've heard about so-and-so. He did this, 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 and this. This is what his power sets are. This is what he's done. And then you never hear about him again. You've just had 2 pages of explanation of this character who doesn't show up ever again in the story. Might not even show up at all in the story. They're just talking about him. But this happens continually through the story. Z is aware of this. It's in my review. He read it and we talked about it. And he's okay with that. But it's one of those cases where it's like, it's great world building, but it's unnecessary world building. And that novel would have been a lot shorter had it been cut out.
Unnecessary world building isn't necessarily a bad thing. But I think in the last little while, I've made it known just how much I tend not to like exposition. Because it feels like a very unnatural way of explaining things. It's almost like a way of artificially building your world.
Sasuke's temper tantrum about the exposition.
See, for me, I find pacing is an important aspect in my writing and how I like to read things. And that's where exposition annoys me. I don't annoy exposition as being exposition, but, you know, if you've got, like, dialogues moving along and the characters are actions and then we stop to describe a page of you know, this is what everything they're in right now. We just slammed into a wall so we can sit, slow things down, and then pick things back up.
They're having a sword fight, and you pause halfway through to explain why they're having a sword fight.
Oh, that really interrupts it.
Ocean, I think I showed you. This is the most recent example that I have.
Kyle's?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
In Dude, Where's My Fox? You've got this... That you've got the main character who is explaining how he got mugged, and his boss comes up. He's like, "Hey, you're talking on the job," and so he's like, "I got mugged," and then it goes into like a full several paragraphs of exposition,
talking about his boss
and you're like,
the situation.
You're like, "That's great. I know nothing about his boss, and I now do." But you completely chop the story like down the middle.
Well, and you don't need to
with
know
this
about
explanation
his boss at that
of
point.
Yours.
This is the same sense,
and you never see the boss again.
Yeah.
Where, you know, people don't like flashbacks that suddenly happen because you've now cut out the pacing and dropped it back. You know, it's awkward.
There's a difference between the old man telling a story and your narrator going, "Hold on, let me stop the story so that I can explain this detail."
Yeah.
So, kind of going back to what Condrell said, and this is something that I struggle with, you know, how do you know what to cut out, what needs to go? Well, mine is actually more the reverse, is that I have the picture so well in my head of what's going on or what everything looks like that I forget to describe that in a sense. So how do you find that balance between what you need to cut or what you need to add, other than beta readers going, you know, "I didn't get this picture," or "Can we move on?"
Well, yeah. my way is, as I said earlier, interaction with the characters. Unless it's something that has no relevance, if it has to have relevance to your character and what he's doing or where he is or the situation he's in, if he's directly involved in the politics of the kingdom of, you know, Uthala, then this and currently he's having an argument with their princess because they're supposed to get married, you might want to explain why that is, but you're not going to sit there and talk about the full on interpolitical war that's been going on for 10 years or whatever. You're going to talk about the points that specifically deal with why your character is betrothed to this princess who's being a bitch, why she's upset and why your guy's upset, so on and so forth.
The way that I try to deal with my world building caveats is, like I was saying, in regards to furry world building, I make notes. I try to be consciously aware based on the feedback that I've received from other people, such as beta readers. I can't send off my story to somebody every time. I'm like, oh, well, maybe this part of the world needs to be different. I'll mark it and try to remove myself from the writing as much as I can before modifying it and moving on.
Actually, with the beta readers thing, that is something you have to learn from your beta readers. When I started writing, I didn't put enough exposition into my stories, and it was like my world, like my settings were very bland and very dull, and it wasn't until Rachan and Condral were like, you know, they're in the stock room, you should describe the stock room a bit more to set the setting, because right now, you know, what does the main character look like? You haven't described them at all, and it's like, oh.
But it's a stock room.
But if you've never worked retail, like,
that seems like such a similar odd concept.
Where I had my museum room, where I'm like, there's a skylight, there's a few paintings, some lights on them, and then a cool tile floor, and then the object in the middle. And one person who will be listening to this podcast, was like, I feel they're floating in air. And then other people were like, well, that's just kind of how a museum room
fits. Yeah, it's a stock museum
room. On my behalf, maybe I could have put more parts of the room throughout the dialogue or throughout the scenes to remind you where you are.
I still argue it's a little bit like quantum physics, and every time you take a step, you have to assume the floor will be there when you put your foot down.
Ooh.
Because I don't have to describe to you that there's a floor, it already exists. There may not be a floor, but there's definitely going to be the world when you put your foot down.
It's like they're stepping on the floor. You can describe the floor. It's tile.
It echoed along the empty walls of the museum.
You can describe that it's marble tile. You can describe it's white marbled tile.
Give your world character, but like it's not strictly necessary.
If you sit there and go into this innate detail of the room, of the fact that it's a white marble floor cut into 12 by 12 squares grouted with white grout, you do that with everything in there.
It was freshly polished. It looked like it had been cut by a man named Jack.
I didn't know these things.
the story that I've been writing most recently has been what I feel is very good practice in world building, because I find myself having to concentrate more. Like when you try to design a world that is so different from the one that you already exist in, you really have to think about what descriptions are important. So like I found myself writing two very similar worlds that are supposed to be very different from each other, because there's one like quote unquote wildly different version of this world that I default to. And so taking the time to actually consider, you know, how can I make this world just as whimsical as the last, but still make it entirely different?
You know, going back to what you guys had said before about, you know, the little details of a furry civilization and how this works and how that works.
Yeah.
And how no one ever sees it. I think it kind of goes back to Condral's comments as well, in the sense that, what is that actually doing for your plot?
I don't think it says anything for the plot, but it definitely, well, it sets the tone for world building.
Mm-hmm. But if you go back to Condral's way, and, you know, that might not be your way.
Yeah.
What is it doing for your story? Like, what is it actually doing? Is someone blown away by the fact that you don't have this one detail set and can't understand your story because of it? Or just can't get involved in it because of it?
This somewhat comes back to, you know, the hard science fiction writers and readers versus the other people. Some people aren't going to care if, you know, your furry characters don't blow themselves dry.
They'll just assume that there is some method that they use to get unwet. Yeah.
Some people will assume. And then, of course, you have nitpickers who think the floor doesn't exist and that, you know, they wouldn't do this certain thing a certain way. I'm like, I know I keep defaulting to this kind of answer, but how much detail do you want to have in your story? What kind of readers are you trying to sell your story to?
I think,
a valid thing to default to?
I mean, with any story that you're writing, you're technically writing for yourself first, because you're writing the stories you want to read, and then you're writing for your guys second. So it really does come down to how much level of detail do you want to put in personally. We've all read, and hopefully our listeners have read as well. Otherwise, you're doing it wrong. And you know what you enjoy reading. You know the level of detail and the level of world building that you enjoy. Do you enjoy your Wheel of Time level of detail, or Game of Thrones, or Lord of the Rings? Or do you enjoy your military science fiction level where it's just kind of whatever, or, you know... We all have that amount that we want to see, and then we will write. Obviously, you will write your stories, give it to your beta readers, and they will tell you whether or not it's enough.
Like we've all written stories that our heart wasn't in it.
Oh yeah,
and it shows. So I, you know, you always strive to be better. You always strive to write more quality work, but. If your heart's just not in it, then is there really a point to trying to conform to somebody else's level of world building?
As a writer who has yet to write another story in the same quote-unquote world as another story that I've written in, I believe you've done it.
Mm-hmm.
You talk about your worlds. I don't know about you two.
I might have done it inconsequentially. Easier,
or do you find that people notice it's the same world even? Because like, I've talked to other writers that have been like, oh, these are in the same world, though they're on completely different continents, so... But how does writing in the same world work with your world building?
It makes it easier.
Do you leave details as well to make sure that people can connect?
Well, because I enjoy those little details that are there as the appetizers for you to taste. I really enjoy it when, you know, because I enjoy it so much, I want to put it in there. Eat you up. You're like a flock of bats.
I was like, it was a bee this time. And then I'm like, no, I'm going to join it.
So, but that's for me when I do my world building. I intentionally do it now. Because I'm like, oh, well, if I put this mention of this in here, like, for example, Dungeon Grind, they make one mention of the encroaching tigers from the east, which ties into a story that's unwritten. But that also gives me potential later on to go, I can write something either from their point of view or someone who's actually directly affected by this encroaching Eastern influence. And it's just, I do it because that's what I want. And that's what I enjoy reading, and thus I'm going to put it in there. And the more and more I do it, the easier and easier it is to write further stories and do further world building, because I've already set that foundation.
What I was going to mention is that your question actually reminds me of an interview that I did while I was more heavily involved with Unfurled. And I'd asked a similar question, and yes, their answer was that it's easier. It's, you know, it's almost kind of a pseudo form of laziness, because you already have this world pre-built for you. You've already written it. You've already put the thought in.
It's familiar territory.
You pluck from that story. You write more other characters, but your world's the same. And then, so if you keep creating new worlds for the stories that you're writing, then you're always going into uncharted territory.
I'm pretty sure I've brought this up in the past, but that reminds me of my favorite world-building example was Andre Norton. She created the Witch's World and basically opened the doors. I swear, she's got to be one of the first anthology creators. But she basically said, here's my world. I'm inviting all these authors to write their own stories in my world. So she gave them the basis. You know, this is the map. This is the people. This is their cultures. Have at her. And some of my favorite short stories, even 20 years later come out of those The Witch's World series, and I think she stopped at 6, which kind of broke my heart. But you know, it's something I would heavily suggest some of our listeners to check up, to listen to read up on. It's fantasy, and it's Andre Norton, spelled like it sounds, and it's in the fiction section, and it's beautiful world building, and it's a collaborative world building.
But you know, I think part of the reason that I haven't come back to the same story yet, like the same kind of world, is because I feel like I'm still spreading my wings as a writer. I write new stories, and I'm still coming across these different genres, these different worlds that are so fun to write. And I don't see a reason to go back to the old ones yet.
Like, that's why I'm jealous of your time/dimension thing, is because
you can connect all the worlds.
you can connect all the worlds, but at the same point,
I'm an 1800s Ireland. Don't be jealous; now.
It's a pain in the ass.
Well, no, it's because it is the appeal of shows like Doctor Who and Sliders and all that, where you are going into these new worlds where you can do new things. Same thing with Star Trek. It's, unless you're on DS9 and stuck in the middle of nowhere.
And you're funny enough, that's like my least favorite one.
Yeah, well, exactly. And
it's so boring.
You're exploring all these new worlds and whatnot. There's an anthology that was released by Chaosism called Extreme Planets. It's science fiction. The entire theme of the anthology is extreme planets. So you're world building, like, this huge, amazing world that's deadly, and then you're trying to do a plot on it. I mean, it's
like, at the same time, like, it's mentally exhausting.
Oh, it's
you try to come up, like, I've done 4 different worlds in the same story, and trying to think up,
you can put your 4 down.
trying to think up original good ideas of what to do, like, 4 times over in your story
is
very taxing. And it's also not short. It's supposed to be 10,000 words.
Yeah.
It's currently sitting at 14.5. It almost has to be a novel.
That's what I was having the problem with, the one story I wrote after I got all the world building and the reason why these characters existed in the state they existed in. It was like, well, goddammit, I have like 2,000 words left before my cap. I'm gonna...
And that's where, with, as Condro was stating, especially if you're doing short stories, you have to start chopping, because otherwise it's not going to fit, and you're just going to end up with this world building story that has no actual plot to it.
I'm not
accusing you of that, but that's what I'm just saying, is you have all these people who are, that's what they're putting down, and that's when you have to take the axe to it.
But part of me, like, with this story, part of me is like, ah, damn, I'm over this story limit by like 5,000 words, and it's only going to go up.
Yeah.
The other part of me is like, yes, I've written 15,000 words to a novel.
Yeah.
And I haven't decided which
direction kind of, you want to take it.
What I want to do with it. So, like, but it's been a very valuable lesson in building a robust world, because I've never really put that much thought into most of my stories as far as that goes. They've always been very small, isolated worlds. You know, which is why I write most of my stories in coffee shops and apartment buildings and
all that fun stuff.
Actually, that kind of makes me think of something. This was brought up once before in this group. What's everyone's thought on world building when you include the coffee shop?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah!
The coffee shop.
The coffee shop!
Didn't we rant about this on the last
one? Yes, exactly!
What's wrong with the coffee shop?
It's used all the time and everywhere.
Yeah, because coffee shops are everywhere and used by everyone.
Well, like, you think about...
That's my argument, too.
Yeah, well, you think about the one...
I don't think it's a weird thing, because that's what people do.
You think about the one place you default to meet somebody new. It's a coffee shop.
Well, yeah. It's safe.
Coffee shops on different dimensions.
On
different planets.
I was going to say...
How will your coffee shops...
Everyone needs their coffee.
You're introducing people to your world by bringing them into the coffee shop. And then you slowly, like, you begin to spread outside the coffee shop, and you show them the rest of your world. It's like getting to know a new person.
Getting to know you. Sorry.
The King of
I want to be the king. Anne is a wuss.
See, that's one of the things that gets me, is I've had people like Friday and Munchkin sit there and talk about like my cyberpunk story and sit there and talk about how they want to see more in that world because of how, you know, how I've set it up. But at the same point, the only thing that I've done setting it up is I've put those little hooks in just to draw people in so that they come and see it and they want to see more. It's just, it's also one of those worlds where I was like, I struggled so much with this. Fuck this shit. I don't want to do any more in this world.
And, you know, some of these worlds I really do want to go back to. I mean, but because you have things like, you know, Savior in
you're thinking Pulp.
Pulp. Thank you. you know, that story left itself very open for new stories.
Well,
that's also part of the Pulp genre, too, if you've done it correctly.
Well, it's like Jericho Tanner and the Ebon Star.
Or Titus.
Titus. I could sit there and write, and like, I could write Jericho Tanner stories for like years and be perfectly happy doing so.
I liked reading them.
And the thing is Jericho Tanner is the precursor to Jareth, who takes over Jericho's store, and I was actually in the process of writing a novel with, which is what she was reading. But that's just because I had that world built. And actually, to go back to what Ocean said, it made it so much easier to write because I already had this pre-existing world that Jareth existed in, and I was just like, well, he has this shop that's not his shop. Well, who owned it before him? Jericho did. What's Jericho? Jericho is a tabby cat, actually. Not tabby, sorry. He's a white-yellow cat. And then it goes from there.
Jericho's white-yellow?
No, he's yellow. He's not white yellow, sorry. He's yellow because he's the cat that came back.
Very nice.
I think part
that's why he never dies.
Part of
didn't realize he was yellow.
He says he's yellow in the very opening.
I think maybe a little bit of wanting to revisit the worlds that you've built. Like you like of all.
I was trying to see if you had Pulp here, and then I realized
no. Actually, I do. It's on the other computer.
Oh yes.
Of all the persistent worlds we've been talking about, you know, continuing with our stories, none of them have really been these like real world, like modern day kind of stories.
The thing is when you write in the modern genre, as we were saying, on one level it's easy because you don't have to do any world building. That said, because it is in the modern setting, it's a lot less conducive to actually continuing on with the plot line unless you have interesting characters.
It doesn't really have the same effect as something that's drastically different from what, you know, your regular everyday life is.
Yeah, and I mean that's what it comes down to is just you don't everyone lives the, you know, every day unless your characters are interesting people, you just don't give a shit. Anyway, I think we're pretty much done with this.
So, what are our take home points? Just something we really should do at the end of these episodes.
Yeah. Your take-home points are write what you enjoy reading.
World building is a personal thing.
I think world building is not just sitting explaining what the world is. It's more actually talking about how the things in the world interact.
No exposition.
Well, exposition within reason.
Yeah.
Because otherwise your story is nothing but character actions and talking.
You can still paint that backdrop or, you know, talk really in-depth about Rain, but that's not as much world building as it is seeing how the people interact in your world, how they interact with things in your world, with seeing how your world interacts with them.
And I think a practice in world building ties in with a bit of general advice that I give out to people is write things you're not familiar with.
Well, think of a picture of a landscape. You know, you can see like a nice set of mountains, some autumn trees.
See, I'm thinking like the landscaping they do in The Hobbit or something.
Well, just, okay, so you can see a picture and you'd be like, okay, it's the mountains, maybe it's crisp, maybe, I don't know, it looks like fall. That's all I know. But if you're there or someone's telling you about their fall vacation in the mountains and how, oh, we saw these animals and this is what the people were like and, you know, this is the sights and the sounds, which of those is going to pull you more into what it would be like to be there? Just seeing a picture of it or hearing everything that went on there?
Or like, well, I went to Mount Fuji, we walked and ate dinner.
That sounds
done.
So
like, that's such a boring story.
So.
Anyways.
No. And as Condrell says, you know, if you're a beginning writer, it's easy to get hooked up on your world building, same as it is for research and all that.
Guilty.
Just remember, you don't have to put everything in it. Write your story. Just sit down and write it. The stuff that is important for your world building will come as you write.
You don't have to put a ring on it. It's in fact preferable if you put the ring on it and then chop the ring off afterwards.
My finger.
Yep.
Awesome. So, next week, we've already decided we're going to talk about horror.
Yep.
Next week is going to be scary.
It's finally coming about. With the spoopy approach of MFF and the final end of the journey to see Abandoned Places, see Print.
Where's that coming out at?
MFF. Fur Planet's Table.
You mean Midwest Fur Fest?
Yes, I actually don't know what MFF stands for.
Midwest Fur Fest.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
So hopefully it will be me and a special guest answering all the questions from everybody else.
Sorry.
So check in on that. Also, we still need ideas for our Christmas stories. So please give us...
Those are going to be so much fun. Come on, please, people, play with us.
We need characters. We need stereotype for characters. We need settings. We need plots. Just give us a bunch of ideas. We'll pick the best and go from there. But the exercise will be to show that despite given the same stuff, all four of us will write completely different stories.
Wouldn't it be really funny if we all basically wrote the same thing?
That would be amazing.
It would.
That would be more of a testament to our skill than anything else.
Or that we spend way too much time together.
Otherwise, you can email us at podcast@fangsandfonts.com. We're on Twitter @fangsandfonts. We're on Facebook, Fangs and Fonts. Check us out. Our website is also fangsandfonts.com. We'd love to hear from you guys. Any suggestions, any comments, any complaints?
Send them all to us.
We want to hear it from
you.
You
too can be like Condrell and be read on the air.
If you like us, tell a friend. You know, annoy a friend.
The email contains
lock them in a car
feedback
and play this podcast and tell them you're going to drive somewhere until you've heard them all.
To be fair, we listen to the podcasts when we drive to Edmonton fairly often. So
Whenever I'm in a car, it's a podcast.
Yeah.
I don't really listen to music anymore.
We went on one trip. We just listened to the opening lines of every single podcast and laughed ourselves silly.
Our podcast?
Oh, yeah. No,
great.
Dude, go back and listen to like the gift bag or the grab bag episode.
Just how they all start.
And it's just like, because that's the one that starts off with, I have a ferret. I have a ferret in me, and then laughing, and then you're like, want to see it war dance, and she loses her shit.
Want to see
it
war dance?
So anyway, listen. Watch Roland war dance. No, you don't. There's a lot of thrashing on the floor. Booze may be involved.
Like a
mantrum. Okay, I'm getting sleepy. Good
night. Good night, everyone.
Thanks,
take care,
everybody. Good
bye-bye.
Night.
Keep on writing.